Hello again on Wednesday, February 17th, 2016, for part two of Decatur Tribune. No, not Decatur Tribune, Herald and Review with Debbie, starting as we usually do with the death notices. Lincoln, Boyer, Charles William Jr. Charles William Bill Boyer Jr. passed away Saturday, February 13th, 2016, at Symphony of Lincoln in Lincoln, Illinois. Honoring Bill's wishes, cremation services will be provided by Graceland Fairlawn Crematory. A memorial service will be planned at a later date. Memorials would go to Symphony of Decatur Activity Fund. Decatur, Dombrowski, Ralph R. Ralph R. Dombrowski, 93, of Decatur, passed away Thursday, February 11th, in his home. Services to celebrate Ralph's life will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, February 20th, at St. John's Lutheran Church on Union Street in Decatur, with Pastor Russell J. Wise officiating. Visitation will be from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, February 19th, at the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Burial with military honors conducted by the Macon County Honor Guard will be in Graceland Cemetery. Memorials in Ralph's honor are suggested to St. John's Lutheran Church. Decatur, Dierdorf, Sandra. Sandra, Sandy Dierdorf, 63, of Decatur, passed away on Friday, February 12, 2016, at Hickory Point Christian Village. A graveside service to celebrate Sandy's life will be held at noon on Friday, February 19th, at Fairlawn Cemetery. Memorials may be made to the Homeward Bound Pet Shelter. Dawson and Wyckoff Westwood Street Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. Decatur, Doubt, Marilyn J. Doubt is spelled D-A-U-T, perhaps Dote. Marilyn J. Dote, 78, of Waukegan, formerly of Decatur and Pittsfield, passed away Tuesday, February 9, 2016, in her home. Services to celebrate Marilyn's life will be 1 p.m. Saturday, February 20th, 2016, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Burial with military honors conducted by the Macon County Honor Guard will be in Fairlawn Cemetery. Flowers may be sent to Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Decatur, Brady, Patricia Eva. Patricia Eva Brady, 74, a Decatur, passed away in her home February 15, 2016, with her family by her side. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, February 19th, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Memorials may be directed to the Cancer Care Center in Decatur. Decatur, Ziegler, Daniel L. Daniel L. Ziegler, 65, a Decatur, died Saturday in his home with his family by his side after a short illness. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Sunday, February 28th, in Cerro Gordo Brethren Church. He donated his body to science. Memorials can go to Cerro Gordo Brethren Church, Deacon Love. Decatur, Powell, Vernon Leroy. Vernon Leroy Powell, 82, a Decatur, formerly of Alma, died Sunday, February 14, 2016, in his home. Services will be 1 p.m. Thursday in Roger Atkins Funeral Home, Salem, with Todd Maxwell officiating. Visitation will be 2 hours before services. Burial will be in Martin Cemetery, Alma, with military rites by Salem American Legion. Memorials suggested to cancer care specialists. Decatur, Parkhurst, Donald J. Colonel Donald J. Parkhurst, U.S. Air Force retired, 84, passed away Saturday, February 13th. On Saturday, February 20th, from 2 to 5, there'll be a celebration of Donald's life at the Cerro Gordo American Legion Hall on the corner of 220 West Waite Street across from the grade school. Interment will be at a later date at Arlington National Cemetery. Brettlinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur, is handling the arrangements. Hillsdale, Brennan Michelle Lynn. Michelle Lynn Turner Brennan, 46, of Ivesdale, passed away at 5:07 p.m. on Saturday, February 13th at Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Visitation will be held on Friday, February 19th from 4 to 7 at the Bement United Methodist Church on Pyatt Street in Bement. Celebration of Life services for family and friends will be at 11 a.m. on Saturday, February 20th, also at the Bement United Methodist Church. The pastor, Mike Henninger, will officiate. Memorial contributions can be made to the Michelle L. Brennan Memorial Fund in care of the State Bank of Bement in Ivesdale. Comstock, Charlotte June. Charlotte June Comstock, known to her family as Bobby, passed away peacefully on February 13th. Bobby was born the daughter of Marie and Homer Lightly on May 16, 1931, in Deer Park, Ohio, and was raised in Gas City, Indiana. A memorial service will be held on Friday, February 19th at 11 a.m. in the chapel of Mowell Funeral Home on Robinson Road, Peachtree City, Georgia. In lieu of flowers, memorial gifts may be made in Charlotte's name to the Alzheimer's Association in Chicago. Carl J. Mowell and Son Funeral Home Peachtree are in charge of arrangements. Herrick, Richardson, William Sr. William Roger Richardson Sr., 73, of Herrick, passed away Monday, February 15th, in his home. All services will be held at the Herrick Baptist Church. The visitation will be held Friday, February 19th, from 4 to 8, and the funeral service will be Saturday at 11 a.m. Burial will be at the Antioch Cemetery, Herrick, with full military honors. Services will be officiated by Jay Huddleston. In lieu of flowers, a memorial has been established in his name. Family is requested casual attire. Lockhart Green Funeral Home, Cowden, is assisting the family, and online condolences may be left at their website. Mount Pulaski, Allspach, Donald L. Donald L. Allspach, 80, of Mount Pulaski, passed away at 5:10 a.m. Sunday, February 14th, at his home. Services for Donald will be at 10 a.m. Friday, February 19th, at Mount Pulaski Christian Church, with Mark Weber officiating. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, February 18th, at the Mount Pulaski Christian Church Family Life Center. Masonic services will be held at 7 p.m. Thursday evening. Burial will be at the Steenbergen Cemetery. Memorials may be given to the Shriners Children's Hospital or the Mount Pulaski EMS. Services are entrusted to Frick Calvert Schrader Funeral Home in Mount Pulaski. And the last obituary that we have for today from the paper is Pena McCracken, Joseph L. Joseph L. McCracken, 90, of Pena, died Saturday, February 13th, peacefully in his home after failing health for the last month. He was surrounded by family and friends and left to be with his late wife, Joan, just in time for Valentine's Day. Funeral services will be Saturday, February 20th, in the First United Methodist Church at 10 a.m. Pastor Stephen Palmer, Pastor Rick Miles, and Bishop Damasui officiating. Burial will be in Roseman Grove Cemetery in Roseman. For those who wish to honor Joe's life with a memorial gift, donations are requested to Loaves and Fishes Food Pantry in Pena. End of that section. On the same page, under Lifestyles, is kind of a different article. Museum gets bad vibes from neighbors. This is from AP writer Kathy Matheson, Philadelphia. An archaeology museum in Philadelphia has moved thousands of ancient treasures off-site and is using vibration sensors to monitor delicate items still on display while an earth-shaking demolition project continues next door. The Penn Museum, which houses mummies, the Sphinx, pottery, and other historical pieces excavated worldwide, has also modified exhibits to prevent damage to fragile objects and ensure they can remain on view. We've tried to minimize our impact on the visitors, so we're keeping things up as long as we can and as much as we can, said head conservator Lynn Grant. The museum is part of the University of Pennsylvania, which has been dismantling a nearby 850-car parking garage and 23-story medical office tower to make room for a new hospital pavilion. Demolition should be finished by August, said Patrick Doris, an associate vice president for the university's health system. However, the museum's seismic challenges won't end then, because the hospital construction will require digging into bedrock. No timeline has been set, Doris said. Vibrations from heavy machinery, quote, can really mess with the integrity of the artifacts, unquote, and cause some to move within their exhibits, said Museum Special Projects Coordinator Robert Thurlow. The museum cares for about 1 million items, but only a small percentage is displayed to its more than 160,000 annual guests. The rest are in storage, on loan, or being studied in labs by students and researchers. Officials with the museum and health system, which is paying the yet-to-be-calculated moving and storage costs, have been coordinating closely for more than a year. The ongoing changes are large and small, both visible and invisible to the public. Visitors won't notice that most of the Egyptian collection in on-site storage has been moved off the premises. They won't see the new shock-absorbing layer of material under the case housing 1,400-year-old horse figurines from the Tang Dynasty. They probably won't realize that glass shelves in some displays have been replaced by sturdier wood or acrylic boards. Guests will notice the walls of the ancient Egyptian tomb chapel of Kippur have been disassembled and the closure of the Islamic Near East Gallery. In June, they'll see that workers have removed a pair of 500-year-old Buddhist murals made of mud plaster that have adorned the museum's signature Chinese rotunda for nearly a century. Officials hope to replace them temporarily with replica scrims. Quote, it's difficult to anticipate every single fixture or shelf and how they're going to respond to vibrations, said Andrew Smythe, a Columbia University professor of civil engineering and engineering mechanics who serves as a consultant for the project. You have so many objects and they're represented and displayed in so many ways and they all have their own unique fragilities. Vigilance has required museum staff to babysit galleries during night demolition work. Employees also get cell phone alerts from the vibration sensors when certain thresholds are reached. And Grant said they've learned to recognize the difference between truly unusual movements and large school groups tramping through the mummy room. There have been a few emergency calls to the demolition site superintendent when the shaking becomes too intense, according to Thurlow, but nothing's been damaged. Staff members have inventoried items while evaluating them for temporary removal and preservation work. That's led to the rediscovery of objects that have been in storage for decades and some which haven't been unpacked since their original excavation. We're finding a lot of neat things that people really haven't looked at or haven't researched since the 40s or 50s, Thurlow said. Museum's officials stressed that there's still plenty to see. The newest exhibit, The Golden Age of King Midas, opens Saturday and runs through November 27th. End of that article. Some items from Section B, Sports. Mount Zion bounces back, top St. Teresa. Decatur, with 2 minutes left before halftime in a sluggish game, Mount Zion found its rhythm. Kevin Cox sliced his way through the paint in St. Teresa's defense for a couple of buckets before Jonas Smith played a cat-and-mouse game, then sunk a runner just before half. The Braves fired out the half just as quickly, and by the time Chuck Kuhl drove into the lane for a basket, Mount Zion was well on its way to an easy 63-49 win against the Bulldogs on Tuesday night. Next, Hobbled Hill helps Illini. This is by Mark Tupper, the executive sports editor. The article on Mount Zion was by Aaron Dow, the staff writer also. Champaign, in the pregame warm-ups Tuesday, Malcolm Hill looked like an old man. His leg looked stiff, and he winced trying to get loose, feeling a deep pain in his right hamstring, the result of a fall in practice on Monday. No doubt about it, Illinois' leading scorer was going to have to make a game-time decision. Hill decided he could fight through the pain, and he played a decisive role in Illinois' 81-66 victory over Rutgers before the smallest State Farm Center crowd of the season. Hill posted his seventh double-double of the season, leading Illinois with 22 points and 10 rebounds. Hill did a great job, Illini coach John Grosch said. He showed a lot of courage today. Rutgers was shorthanded, down to 7 scholarship players due to injuries and suspension. Corey Sanders, the flashy freshman guard who scored 39 points in Illinois' triple overtime victory on February 3rd, was serving the first game of his 4-game suspension for violating team rules. I think they're talking about the Illini there. Without Lewis, Rutgers was serious. Well, maybe not. Rutgers was shorthanded, down to 7 scholarship players due to injuries and suspension. Without Lewis, Rutgers was seriously lacking firepower against an Illini team that closed out the first half by scoring on 11 consecutive possessions. Illinois goes back on the road this weekend and visits Wisconsin at 6:30 p.m. on Sunday. Lastly, on the front of the sports page, Illinois to go with Whitman as new AD. This is by Mark Tupper, the executive sports editor. Champagne. Josh Whitman, whose athletic life has been marked by a track record of undeniable smarts and a relentless work ethic, is the new director of athletics at the University of Illinois. Whitman, 37, has been the AD at Division III Washington University in St. Louis since June 2014. Prior to that, he was AD at another Division III school, Wisconsin La Crosse, for 4 years. Interim Chancellor Barbara Wilson is contacting donors today with the news, and she'll be on hand to introduce Whitman on Thursday at a press conference in the Hall of Fame room of the Bielefeld Athletic Administration Building. Whitman is no stranger to the Illinois campus. He was a football player and an All-Big Ten academic honoree for 4 seasons at Illinois, graduating in 2001. He then played for 4 different National Football League teams and returned to Illinois to get his law degree while launching his career in sports administration. Whitman worked for Illini AD Ron Gunther's department from 2005 to 2008. Whitman received his law degree summa cum laude and clerked for the Honorable M.S. Khan on the United States Court of Appeals for the 7th District. He then joined the Washington, D.C. law firm of Covington & Burlington LLP, which serves as the primary outside counsel to the NFL. It was while in Washington, D.C. that Whitman was named athletics director at Wisconsin La Crosse. Whitman fills a seat that's been open since former AD Mike Thomas was dismissed on November 9th. Thomas was deemed to have become what Wilson called a distraction in the wake of charges that football coach Tim Beckman had mishandled injuries and treatment of players. Thomas hired Beckman in December of 2011, and Beckman was fired on August 28, 2015. So among things on Whitman's initial to-do list is to figure out what to do with Illini football. Bill Cubitt, Illinois' offensive coordinator at the time, took over as interim head coach when Beckman was fired and was given a 2-year contract on November 28, the final day of the season. The contract was viewed as a stopgap measure to stabilize the program and to keep Cubitt in place until a new AD could be hired to assess the situation. Greg McMahon, the special teams coordinator for the New Orleans Saints, was Whitman's position coach at Illinois, and he said Illinois is getting one of the brightest minds he's ever known. When you meet him, you can tell immediately how special he is, McMahon said. He's incredibly intelligent, and he's very, very driven, a perfectionist. He wants to do everything right, whether it's taking notes in meetings, knowing assignments, his technique. He never got below an A in his life. He commands respects, and I know that because our quarterback Drew Brees played with him in San Diego, and he thinks the world of Josh. I'm biased, but Josh just has it. End of article. Back in the A section, government and politics, education task force testimony bears plight. Dan Petrella, Springfield Bureau Chief. Springfield, the challenges that come with revamping Illinois school funding formula were on display Tuesday at a hearing of a House Education Task Force. House Speaker Michael Madigan, Democrat, Chicago, convened the task force last year to look at education funding issues and called for another series of hearings this spring. Senate Democrats have been pushing for a change to the funding formula that would send more money to poorer districts. The task force heard from a group of school administrators from the Chicago suburbs whose districts would stand to lose state funding if the money were shifted to districts with lower property values. Superintendent Anu DeRoss of Schaumburg School District told lawmakers that every student deserves the opportunity to succeed. But he said those opportunities should be created through directing new resources to districts in need rather than redistributing the existing pool of state education funding. Likewise, Superintendent Daniel Cates of Palatine-based Township High School District told the panel that his district, the largest high school district in the state, would stand to lose $8 million a year under the formula that's been proposed in a bill proposed by Senator Andy Menar, Democrat, Bunker Hill. That would have a devastating impact, he said, adding that $1 million annually to what it costs to offer 50 classes or to pay for 40 teachers' assistants. Another group of school administrators who attended the hearing but didn't speak described the current system as broken, inequitable, unfair. At my school, we don't have the resources that my counterparts in wealthier districts have for their students, but we get treated the same way that their districts do when it comes to a majority of state-funded handed out year after year, East Aurora High School Principal Anthony Crespo said. It's flawed, it's wrong, and it's hurting children who need the resources the most. State Representative Avery Byrne, Republican Raymond, said she asked to be on the task force because she sees the effect inadequate funding is on rural schools in her district. The school funding formula has disproportionately hurt the schools in downstate Illinois, she said, and we need to make sure that every student, regardless of where they're born, regardless of their zip code, has the same opportunities, Burns said. Avery Byrne, Republican of Raymond. House Majority Speaker Barbara Flynn Curry, Democrat, Chicago, who chairs the task force, said Tuesday's testimony shows the difficulty of crafting a formula that makes school funding both adequate and equitable statewide. End of that article. Going on to politics, Illinois Democrats urge Kirk to take stand on Scalia nominee. The Democrats vying for a chance to replace U.S. Senator Mark Kurt pressed the Illinois Republican on Tuesday to take a definitive position on who should choose a replacement for the late U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. The three Democratic candidates in next month's primary, U.S. Representative Tammy Duckworth, former Chicago Urban League CEO Andrea Zopp, and State Senator Napoleon Harris said during a live-streamed Chicago Sun-Times endorsement session, the nomination process should begin immediately under President Barack Obama. It tugs at the democracy of our nation to not have this justice appointed, Harris said. Scalia's death on Saturday triggered political debates nationwide, but the issue is especially tricky for Kirk, who is one of the most vulnerable Republican senators in the 2016 election and seeking a second term in Obama's home state. As other Senate Republicans in tight contests lined up behind the idea that Obama's successor should nominate Scalia's replacement, Kirk shied away from the issue. End of that article. International. UN stopping Zika may require genetically modified insects. This is AP out of Geneva. The World Health Organization says it may be necessary to use controversial methods like genetically modified mosquitoes to wipe out the insects that are spreading the Zika virus across the Americas. The virus has been linked to a spike in babies born with abnormally small heads, or microcephaly, in Brazil and French Polynesia. The UN Health Agency has declared Zika a global emergency, even though there's no definitive proof it's causing the birth defects. WHO, World Health Organization, said its advisory group has recommended further field tests of genetically modified mosquitoes, which have previously been tested in small trials in countries including the Cayman Islands and Malaysia. Given the magnitude of the Zika crisis, WHO encourages affected countries to boost the use of both old and new approaches to mosquito control as the most immediate line of defense, WHO said in a statement. WHO says at least 34 countries have been hit by the virus in the current crisis, mostly in Latin America. Next week, WHO Chief Margaret Chan will travel to Brazil, the epicenter of the outbreak, to discuss Zika and microcephaly with the country's health minister and other officials, agency spokeswoman Fidelic Cheb said on Tuesday. WHO said who said previous experiments that released sterile insects had been used by other UN agencies to control agricultural pests. The agency described the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes that spread Zika, as well as other diseases including dengue and yellow fever, as an aggressive mosquito that uses sneak attacks to bite people, noting that the mosquito has shown a remarkable ability to adapt. Last month, British biotech firm Oxitec said tests in Brazil in 2015 showed that genetically altered sterile male mosquitoes succeeded in reducing a type of disease-spreading mosquito larvae by 82% in one neighborhood in the city of Piracicaba. The genetically modified males don't spread disease because only female mosquitoes bite. Environmentalists have previously criticized the genetically modified approach, saying wiping out an entire population of insects could have unforeseen knock-on effects on the ecosystem. Some experts agree it might be worth using genetically tweaked mosquitoes given the speed of Zika spread, but we're unsure of the eventual consequences. End of that article. Continuing with crime, courts, etc., man faces two charges in Sunday morning homicide. Decatur. This is by Ryan Voiles from the staff. An alcohol-fueled argument seemed to be the spark that led to Sunday afternoon's death of Jacqueline L. Green, according to police. Brian E. Brummett, 30, is currently in Macon County Jail on $1 million bond on preliminary charges of involuntary manslaughter and aggravated domestic battery after Decatur police officers found Green deceased at the pair's shared residence in the 2300 block of East Finch Drive. The incident began early Sunday morning at the residence as Green, Brummett, and the latter's twin brother consumed a large amount of liquor, according to a sworn statement from the Decatur Police Department. Brian Brummett said during an interview with detectives that Green became upset with Brummett's brother and his girlfriend, who was also at the resident, and began to yell derogatory names at the girlfriend. When Brian Brummett used an expletive and told Green to stop talking, he told police that she struck him in the face and grabbed his hair. As the two fell to the floor and Green continued to throw punches and pull on his hair, Brummett told police he struck Green in the head between 5 and 10 times with a closed fist. Detectives interviewed Brummett's brother at the department, where he gave a similar account of the altercation. He said once Green was struck multiple times, he observed what appeared to be blood around the victim's nose. The brother's girlfriend told police she was in a separate room and awakened by the sounds of the altercation. Upon entering the room, she saw Brummett and Green lying on the floor in a fight, with Green refusing to let go of Brummett's hair. Once Green was struck in the face, the girlfriend told officers she saw the victim let go of Brummett's hair and swelling and bruising develop on her face. Decatur police were called to the residence at 12:30 p.m. Sunday, and Green was declared dead upon their arrival. An autopsy performed Monday on Green revealed she died of subdural hematoma caused by a blow to the head. Green's death is the second homicide of the year in Decatur after 21-year-old Tarek DeWalt was shot and killed in a parking lot of a Northside apartment complex January 14th. Sharice H. Hendricks, 18, is being held on a $1 million bond in the Macon County Jail on a charge of first-degree murder in that case. And the last for Section 2 is also crime in courts. Elroy Mitchell gets 107 years for sex assault of girl by Huey Freeman for the H&R staff. Elroy Mitchell, a 50-year-old Decatur man convicted of repeatedly sexually assaulting a young girl beginning when she was 7 years old, was sentenced to 107 years in prison. With 100 years to be served at a minimum of 85% and 7 years at 50%, he will serve at least 88 and a half years. His victim, who is younger than 14, sat at the prosecutor's table beside Assistant Macon County State's Attorney Kate Kurtz as she read from her victim impact statement Tuesday afternoon. In a clear, calm voice, she told how Mitchell's abuse came to light and the deep mark it left upon her. End of that article that we can read now, and end of Section 2 of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, February 17th, 2016. This is Debbie saying goodbye for now and talk to you again soon.